is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We try to teach it, rep it, and then scrimmage it, and try to put point systems on as much as we can. But also, we've started implementing certain non-negotiables we want in whatever we're doing. Our practice used to be a breakdown of about 75-80% defense, 20% offense, and now I think it's probably more 50-50.
Stan Bonowitz is in his 19th season as the head coach of the Concordia University, Texas men's basketball program. He's also in his ninth year as the department's associate director of athletics. In his previous 18 seasons at the helm, the Tornadoes have registered the program's first ever NCAA postseason victory, captured one league championship, and made three conference tournament title game appearances. Bonowitz earned his 200th career victory on January 25, 2018. Prior to his arrival in Austin, Bonowitz was the associate men's basketball coach at South Plains College in Levelland from 2003 to 2004. He also served a stint as an assistant men's basketball coach at St. Edward's from 2002 to 2003. Bonowitz was a decorated collegiate student athlete at Texas Tech University. He garnered all Southwest Conference freshman team honors in 95-96 and earned honorable mention all Big 12 honors 2 years later. As a point guard, Bonowitz led the Red Raiders to a 30-2 ledger, Southwest Conference title, and an NCAA Sweet 16 appearance in 95-96. He graduated as the all-time assist leader for Texas Tech. While being coached by his father on the scholastic level, Bonowitz led San Antonio's East Central High School to the 1995 Texas State Championship with a perfect 35-0 record. He was also named Mr. Texas Basketball that season and was later inducted into the Texas Sports Hall of Fame.
Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Joe Crispin, head men's basketball coach at Rowan University, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball.
You want to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Stan Bonowitz, men's basketball head coach at Concordia University, Texas.
Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host, Jason Sunkel, tonight. But I am pleased to be joined by Stan Bonowitz, the head men's basketball coach at Concordia University, Texas. Stan, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Mike, thanks for having me on. Looking forward to having this conversation with you.
Absolutely. We are looking forward to diving in and getting to know more about you and learning more about your journey to the point where you've gotten in your college basketball coaching career. Let's start, though, by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Well, you know, I grew up, I guess, just in the environment. My dad was a high school coach. And coached for over 30 years. He coached multiple sports, baseball. He started out at a private school in San Antonio where he went to high school. He coached basketball, baseball, football there, and then transitioned from there to the public school arena and coached at a 5A high school, which is the biggest classification at the time in Texas. Coached there for 20-plus years. So, you know, my experiences were, you know, the experience of a lot of coaches' sons. I was, you know, at practices from, you know, the time it made sense for me to be there. I was riding on the bus. I was sitting on the bench. And so I was getting inside look and perspective on just kind of what the game was about, and had a lot of different influences during that time. And it was great because my father took over a program that was that wasn't a very strong program when he took over. It had been kind of toward the bottom in the city, actually. And he was there a couple of years, and he implemented a system of play, a pressing style that kind of revolutionized the game in the city for about a 10 or 12 year stretch. And, you know, it was something that was different. It was something that the city hadn't seen before. And so to be able to be a part of that and see what that did for the school, for the city, the excitement it brought was pretty cool. So I always tell people, man, that like I had just a inherent advantage over a lot of people because I had access to a gym and to a team from such a young age, kind of year round, you know. So it kind of definitely helped shape and kind of without me even realizing it, put me
How old were you when you realized kind of how lucky you were? Because I think a lot of times you're a kid and it's just, it is what it is, right? That's just the situation that you grew up in. Was there a time when you started to realize like, hey, not a lot of other guys have this opportunity like I've had?
Yeah, I think it took me probably till I was, you know, maybe in college or maybe in post-college. It's probably just something, honestly, in the last maybe 10 years or so that I've kind of wrapped my brain around. Because, you know, as you get older, you know, and I've been fortunate to be the recipient of some you know, some accolades for my playing career. And when you take time to really reminisce and you think about it, it kind of helps put perspective on the fact that, and coaching, because when you coach, you know, you see a lot of guys who you feel like work really hard, and you realize that you're not special in that way as a player. You know, it's when you're a player, you think you're working harder than everybody, but you realize that you get older and you can have some perspective that it wasn't so much that I worked harder. I just had more opportunity. And again, I don't think, like you said, when you're in it, you don't know you're in it because you're just going. You're waking up and you're going to school and it's just the routine. You're going to your dad's practice afterward. You're shooting with a guy. You're playing the clock with him afterwards. And then next thing you know, you're playing on the team. Next thing you know, you're having success. And it just kind of starts running together. And it's not, and again, like a lot of people, you think success is a byproduct of your heart, of you, right? Of the hard work I've done and what I've put in. And then once your brain can develop and mature and kind of have some perspective, you're able to see that, yeah, I mean, it was some of that, but it was also just, you know, heck, I was learning lessons about the game when nobody else, you know, at a much earlier age than a lot of people. So I, you know, honestly, it's probably been the last 5 to 8 years that I've been able to mature and reminisce and realize, yeah, I mean, I was a hard worker, but again, I was really fortunate.
Have you had the opportunity, or did you have the opportunity to talk to your dad about where his style of play came from, where the inspiration was? Was he watching something? Did he see something? Was it just coming out of his own mind? Where did he come up with the idea? How did he say, hey, we're going to play this style that just hasn't been played in this area ever?
Yeah, you know, no, it was completely out of his brain. Like my dad is he's the opposite of me. Like he was extremely successful, extremely confident in what he wanted to do. And he wasn't asking anybody else's opinion. I'm like constantly searching for ideas and I'm paralysis by analysis sometimes. And for him, you know, he was at a school that was usually had smaller players, smaller athletes. And San Antonio, they were competing against bigger, larger bodies. And he, you know, they kind of struggle when they would get in some of those opponents, against some of those opponents who were just physically superior. And so he started in 1984, I believe. He started putting a group together. He called them the Wild Bunch. And he would put these five guys in, the five hardest playing guys he had. He'd put them in for like 2 minutes, and they would just press and run crazy, whatever. And the crowd would get so excited they like couldn't wait for the Rowdy Bunch, you know, the Wild Bunch to get in. It was like the thing. And so that spring, he just decided, you know what, we're going to do this for the entire game. Like, heck, you know, it seems to give us a bolt. It seems to fit the makeup of athlete we're going to have and the type of player we're going to have. And maybe it levels off the playing field. And from 1985 to the year we won it in 95, I think he may have missed the playoffs one time, had three state tournament appearances. And really, from the years of 86 to like 89, the city of San Antonio, like he almost got more news coverage than some of the collegiate teams that were in the city, because it was just so different. They were averaging 108 points a game in a high school game. And it wasn't the Loyola Marymount, because that was kind of the time when Loyola was kind of, Paul Westhead was kind of making his mark with the up-tempo. It was a different system. It was based on defensive pressure, and there wasn't a lot of script to the offensive side of things. And so it was a very simple offensive plan, but it wasn't as traditional of guys running lanes and all the stuff that they did with the Marymount. But so when he did that, again, you just saw the student. I mean, we would have literally, there would be games. I remember this is stuff you remember, you know, from when you were a kid. Like, I remember being so excited to get done with school and get over to the high school, because they'd be playing a game. And like the JV game would start at 5:30, the varsity game at 7:30. Well, at 5:15, the lines wrapped around the building to get into the JV game so they could be there for the varsity game. And it was just something infectious, and something about it that just, you know, there was news coverage. There was every week, you know, everywhere we'd go on the road, it would be, you know, the gym would be packed. And it was just a phenomenon that hadn't been seen. And so, again, not only was I fortunate to be a coach's son, I was fortunate to be the son of a coach who was, you know, relatively successful and was kind of an innovator. And, you know, his brain of how he looked at the game 100% influenced how I played, and to this day influences how I coach.
What do you remember about how your dad handled the notoriety and the attention of all those people being at the games? And obviously, different era. We're not talking about the internet age and social media and all those things. But at that time, I'm sure there was plenty of local news coverage and newspaper coverage, and he was getting asked questions. What do you remember? And again, obviously, as a kid, you're not looking at it from the same perspective as you might if you were able to look back on it retrospectively now. But just, what do you remember about how your dad handled that notoriety?
Man, it's interesting that you asked it, because he never changed. He's not a very outgoing. He's more, probably more of an introvert. And so it was just part of what his job was. It clearly was important to him, and it clearly was a big deal, but it didn't. It never. He was always very willing, obviously, to. He was humbled or grateful to just have people caring, and so he was that one that the prices were open in the media. It was an open book, man, and he never lost perspective, which I think also helps. You know, it helped influence me too to just, you know, stay grounded with whatever's going on. He was much better, I will say, at handling losses than I am. Than a lot of coaches I know are. He just compartmentalized it really well, because his mood, you know, he set an expectation for success through intensity and practice and how he approached things. But it was never after a game. Like, he was really good about you know, the disappointment of losing, being, because the expectation was so high, being greater than the maybe tongue lashing or something after a game. I don't remember him ever really after losses or after wins really changing his attitude. I do remember us feeling a certain burden or a certain expectation to carry on. And a disappointment we had in ourselves, but that wasn't influenced by necessarily his words of frustration. He was really good about, after losses, not making it about him. You know what I mean? Like, not making it to where we let him. You never felt like you were playing for him. You really felt like you were playing with each other for the legacy of what the program was. You were trying to all you were trying to do was carry on what the previous guys had done. And he was just kind of the orchestrator, but it was never like, oh man, y'all, you know, I did all this work. And it was, he's always been a wee, and that's not like fraudulent, but there's always been a real thing with him. And so I think that also indirectly, I don't know if he mentioned it, I think it's just his personality. I don't think he had a grand plan with it. I just think that's just how he thought and operated. And I think that kind of helped motivate us to have us excited and other players excited to want to carry on that legacy.
That ability, I think, to be even keeled and not get too high and too low. There's some people who have that ability, and then there's others that don't. And to your point, I think you have to coach to your personality. And It sounds like he was able to do that and to be able to motivate and to be able to just sort of pass on like, hey, here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing it. Here's what's happened in the past. And you guys, and I'm sure, especially you growing up and being as close to it as you were and seeing it firsthand. And just, I'm sure from the time you could be in that gym, you wanted to be a part of that team. You wanted to suit up and play for your dad. And as you look back on those years, what was the best part about playing for your dad? What did you love about playing for him?
I think the, again, you don't realize it until you're finished and you've start playing and operating in different systems. The freedom, the encouragement of expansion of your game. Like, he was really good about always getting us to develop our skill set and to be more than just a position, but be a basketball player. And he just encouraged creativity, and he just encouraged growth. And I think the fact that he got that out of us, and the fact that that was such a big thing for him. I think when you go other places and you see that's not how it is everywhere, it's kind of shocking, because, you know, when we were playing for him, it was so much about, you know, again, expanding your game, being creative, like I figuring out ways to do things differently, and you know, you learn to shoot with both hands and put, you know, I mean you're going through what would be normal warm-up drills, you know, add something to it that had a little flavor, a little bit of that. He was just really, I don't know, just encouraged all of us to kind of express ourselves as players and feel comfortable doing that without the fear of, you know, if you screw up something doing it that way, you're coming out. It's like, no, like, if it's the right idea, the right intention, then we can live with it. And I think that's something that has influenced me as a coach, is the idea of trying to have a vision for our players that maybe is outside of what has been given to them in the past. I don't know if that makes sense.
No, it does. I think what's interesting about what you said there is, and I can certainly relate to this, when you think about yourself, I'm sure, as a coach, and we're going to dive into this a little bit more, but as a player, right, you can only experience the programs and the coaches that you've actually played for. Mm-hmm. So you played for your dad, and you don't know what's going on every place else. And you can imagine that maybe it's different, or maybe there are some parts that are the same or whatever, but the reality is you don't really know. And let's face it, as a high school player, you're probably not even processing or thinking about it in any way, shape, or form of, hey, I wonder what rival school X is doing during
right. Air
crash. You're just not thinking about it in that way. But
no.
Your greater point, when you go out and you start looking at college programs, and we'll talk a little bit about your recruitment here in a minute, but you start looking at, okay, well, what does this coach do? And how does this coach approach it? And what does this program look like? And then when you yourself become a coach, now you're seeing, man, there's a million different ways that we can skin a cat. And you just think about how fortunate you were to be able to grow up and be able to play for your dad and play in the system that you did. And just, as you said, all the advantages that you have that you probably took for granted in the moment, But now looking back retrospectively, you can see again how lucky you were. So let me flip the question around, and I'm not going to use the word what's the worst part of playing for your dad, but how about what was the most challenging part? Was there a part of it that made it tough that he was your dad and not just your basketball coach?
Yeah, there was a couple of, like, my dad, while being like how he was before and after games, during practice, like, my dad was pretty relentless. Like, he was tough. Like he's a big, burly guy, and he's a very serious guy, and he wants you doing things a certain way. And, you know, as his son, that expectation, again, was, I don't know if to say if it was greater, but I definitely felt it. And so, and having, you know, you're 15 or 16, you're just not, or I wasn't, some people may be, you're not like developed cognitively enough to separate those worlds, you know? And so just for 2 hours, you're getting harped on by your dad. And it's hard to realize, man, I'm not at home. You know, this is, I have to flip that switch. And I probably wasn't always, I know I wasn't good at understanding that or processing that. So that was tough. I think, again, as a freshman, like, I moved up halfway through my freshman year, me and another freshman teammate. And, you know, the immediate, first of all, it's so important to you as a basketball player. It's what you do, it's who you are, it's what kind of identifies you. And so, or you identify yourself as. And so there's already this internal pressure to be successful. And you're moving up to a group and of seniors who were good but not great. And you know, we're moving up there, and there's already this, you know, the feeling of like, well, we know why this kid's moving up. And so you're fighting the coach's son narrative for a couple of years. And it was tough. I mean, relatively speaking, to people who have struggles. I mean, but it was for my freshman and sophomore year. It was a challenge to navigate those feelings of you know, the pressure of playing in a game, not playing well, and hearing the chatter in the, you know, in class or in school the next day about, you know, why you're up there and coach's son and all this stuff. And then, you know, the other thing that's interesting is you start to, it's great in a way, because you find out at a young age. Again, another thing you don't realize that you're finding out, but you find out who your friends are. You find out, like, who people are that are really, you know, who care about you, connected to you. Because, you know, because as soon as your friend, quote unquote friend, is not playing, well, you know, it makes it a little bit of a weird situation, you know, because of the relationship with you know, my dad. And so, all of a sudden, there's a little different, maybe feeling that person has toward me. Or you start seeing parents, you know, players' parents who start treating you different whenever you're having success that maybe their son isn't. And you don't understand why, but then you start to realize why. And so I think that's another great thing I learned is, you know, you can start to kind of read through some people. When you're raised by a coach, you see the true side of a lot of people, of a lot of parents. You know, you see the real side of, like, of everything's great. Oh, you know, we love the coach, da, da, da. And then son's not playing. And I remember sitting in the locker room one night, and my dad was just getting an earful from one mom, and she was just going in on him. And I remember sitting out there with the guy, and you know, we were kind of friends, and it was an awkward, you know, space we were sitting in. But the player, you know, felt terrible because he realized that his mom was ridiculous, because the player wasn't doing, and I knew it, but, like, you know, so you see it at that age, and you just realize that you know, parents are parents, and you know, that's just the nature of coaching and kind of what comes with it. So I just think you know, going through all that and it was, you know, it took a couple of years, I think, too, for me to feel comfortable that, you know, that for me to feel like I could play and block that other stuff out of my mind with the all the chatter and all that stuff. So
did you talk to your dad about it in the moment, or have you talked to him about it just in terms of how he handled that situation from his perspective?
You know, we've talked as I've gotten into coaching, and you know, again, he always just, you know, his big thing is don't ever hold the parent against the kid. I don't hold that against the kid or against the player. Like, it's not the player's fault. It's not the player's, you know, every parent loves their kid and every parent expresses that differently. And at the end of the day, if the player's trying and doing what he's supposed to be doing and it's good for the team, then you can't hold that other factor against them. You know, you got to just coach through it and realize a lot of times those kids didn't want to hear that any more than I did or my dad did. You know, like you just realize
right.
that, you know, and so that's his big thing. He's like, hey, you know, if you got somebody upset, yeah, obviously, you know, there's boundaries that have to be created, which I saw it at a young age, how you don't mix those two. And then if it does come to be an issue, make sure it doesn't bias your treatment of that player in a good or bad way. You know, because sometimes it can bias you maybe in a good way or in a way that's good for the player, but bad for the team, because all of a sudden maybe you do feel, or you could feel some internal pressure to change some things based on this stuff. And so just blocking that out and understand how to navigate through that stuff was something I got from that.
Yeah. That's not easy to do. I think that's a challenge for any coach to be able to sort of keep yourself neutral in those situations where parents driving you crazy and man, it's hard to sometimes separate that, but so often I think you'll agree with this, so often when the parent may have an idea of what they think is going on, but I think more often than not, the player deep down, I think, knows and understands what the truth is and what the coach is trying to do. Not every single time, but I think in a lot of cases, there is a separation between, you know, the kid kind of really knows if you injected them with truth serum and you really sat them down, they'd come to the realization that, hey, this kid's better than me or whatever it might be. And the parent is the unrealistic one.
100%. And, you know, unfortunately, at the college level, I haven't had to deal with as much like my dad had to deal with it at the high school level. But there have been some of those meetings. And I've always found it's best to have full transparency with the player. And if it ever gets to that point and you've got to have a sit down, have the player in. And I mean, 9 out of 10 times the truth will come out and things get resolved because you know, there's some part of the story usually hasn't been told.
Right.
But that's been, I've been very fortunate. I think too, it really helps as a coach. As a player, you appreciate when your coach is being honest with their effort and being honest with their follow through of expectations for the team. And I think and that's across the board, all players, you know, treated, you know, let's just say equal, but not, or fair, but not equal, not fair, however they say it. I think there is truth to that. And I think that helps avoid some problems too, is that the players know as a coach that you're working for the best interests of the team and the best interests of them. And I think that allows some of those things to work themselves out.
Have you seen over the course of your college coaching career, have you seen a change in the amount of parent involvement in players' careers? Because obviously when you started, I think we probably want to talk a little bit about your experience as a player and just what you did to get better and how the system was clearly a lot different than it is today. And you probably grew up in a similar way to me where you were working on your game by yourself and you were playing pickup games and you were doing those things as opposed to working with a trainer and playing AAU and doing what kids do today. But the way the system's set up today, parents are much more invested in their kids' careers from a younger age, both in terms of the time that they put into those basketball careers of their kids, but also the money that they put in. Have you seen any change in the amount of parent involvement that you see as a college coach?
I've seen it more from a recruiting standpoint. Yes. Okay. I've seen parents be more engaged, be more aware in some say in some instances of kind of how the process works of what the levels are like, having a little more knowledge of those scenarios. I do think you've seen more communication that comes from parents over maybe non-basketball things through the recruitment process of, you know, whether there's paperwork that needs to be completed or, you know, orientations that need to be signed up for or whatever it may be. I see that probably more the administrative side of getting things done with guys when they're in the process of coming here. I've seen that really, on an uptick recently. But I think, as we all know, the amount of playing, the amount of games and all that is just, I mean, I remember, yeah, whenever I was playing or first started coaching, the tournaments and just kind of the whole organization of the recruitment in summer was just completely different than what it is now. And in some ways it's better, in some ways opportunities are better and you know, chances to play and get exposure is clearly better than what it's been. But in some ways it's also made it to where parents' expectations have gotten to where they're a little bit hard maybe to sometimes meet some of those expectations. But also, you know, you want to give, you know, it's tough with, you know, some of the social media stuff and, the kids posting, you know, if they visit, getting offers and,
right.
And, you know, the big commitment page at all levels, but at the same time, you know, it's their experience and you want them to have a good experience. And if that's part of what their experience is, even though it may be outside the comfort zone of, you know, myself or the coach, it's like, man, this is a special moment for them. Let's make it special. And so adapting to that is something that, we're trying to get better at. I'm trying to get better at as things evolve.
All right, let's go backwards to you as a player and think about the way that you grew up in the game and how you went about getting better. Just tell me a little bit about your experiences as a high school, college player, how you developed your game, what you did to continue to improve and give yourself an opportunity after you finish playing in high school. You obviously go on and have a great career at Texas Tech. So just talk a little bit about how you got better as a player. What was your process?
It was, my dad had a saying, it's like, if you're going to play, it's got to be an obsession, not a hobby. And he gets on the back of shirts. And that was kind of the mantra that he built the program on. And so it started as young as, you know, probably sixth, seventh grade with the Pistol Pete homework basketball videos that I'm sure you had. Those were things that were done. I was just in the gym. But it wasn't until I became probably a freshman in high school that I started to really commit myself to the year-round process of, you know, 6 days a week. I gave myself one day off a week, but I was going to be in a gym, getting some type of work in. And, you know, I became, you know, the goal became, hey, be the first one to the gym, the last one to leave. And so I was going to make sure if nothing else, that would be kind of my edge, I guess, was the fact that I was just going to put time in and I was going to make sure I felt like I was outworking everybody, you know, as whoever I was in competition with. And so it was, whether it was me in the gym, you know, my dad would have a thing where we'd be the last ones in and I'd hit a shot and I literally would shoot the lights out because he would, if I hit a shot, he'd turn two off. And then if I miss, he'd turn one on. And we had this whole switch. So I was literally by the end of it shooting pitch black. We'd start back over. And so, you know, it's doing that kind of stuff. It was, you know, had the strength shoes and was in the street running with a parachute on and I wanted to make sure I wasn't physically that gifted. I tested my vertical one time. I think it was like 21 inches or something.
Hey, you and me, Stan, we're right there.
Hey, it was unbelievable. I was I was the ultimate land lover, you know? And so I wasn't going to out physical anybody. I wasn't going to out run anybody and that stuff. So I had to have something. And my something was, I was going to have even if it was real to me. It was an inner confidence that I had put the time in to where I deserved to be on the floor with and against anybody. And that carried on through college. And I just tried to stick with it because I felt like if I didn't, then my opportunities were going to be lessened. And I didn't, you know, I didn't have a, well, if it's good or bad, but when I first started playing, my ultimate goal was, you know, just to be a varsity player by my junior year. And then it's like, okay, hey, my dad played at St. Mary's in San Antonio, a Division II program, was in their Hall of Fame. If I could be recruited by someplace like St. Mary's and have a chance to play college basketball somewhere, it would be phenomenal. And so, you know, it was never about working to play at this or this level. As those opportunities came, it was great. But the goal was just, man, I wanted to. I never felt like I was good enough to not work, you know. And so, you know, that was kind of my thing. I think if you asked guys that I played with, I think they would echo that, you know, I was at the time, I guess, gym rat or whatever you want to call it, and was just somebody that stayed in there. And, you know, I was, and also I had some innate ability that came with being in the gym of just understanding how to play and some IQ things that with working pretty hard gave me those opportunities, I think.
How'd you balance your time between working on your game by yourself versus finding pickup games to play in?
You know, I was very much about getting my personal work in. I was going to get that in. That was going to supersede a pickup if it had to. Now, ideally, what we would do in high school in the summers is we'd, in the morning, we'd get up there at this gym at maybe 9 o'clock and work 9 to noon, eat lunch, and then all the older guys. And this is when I was playing in ninth grade, 10th grade, when we were first kind of at East Central gym. They'd have open gyms in the summer, were huge. They'd have guys from all over cities. The college guys would come back, pro guys would come in, and they'd get there about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. So me and two or three other guys that were freshmen, so we'd get up there early, and we'd spend the morning working, shooting, doing whatever. And then they'd show up, and we'd play 1 to 3:30, 1 to 4. And then as we got older and started having, you know, driver's license, all that stuff, then we would go, we'd eat dinner. Then we would go 2 or 3 nights a week to another gym in the city. Because back then, high schools would have the open gym. So you would just find, okay, they're playing at Alamo Heights, they're playing at John Jay, they're playing at whatever. And so that's where we'd go that evening. So you would just kind of shift around. Your afternoons would be spent at East Central, your evenings would be spent somewhere else. And then weekends, we'd go. There were a couple of military bases in San Antonio that were always good spots to go on weekends, and we'd go there and play. And so I was going to 100% play pickup, but I was so obsessive about getting in my individual work that I was never going to sacrifice that and miss that and just play. I always felt a little bit naked or empty if I didn't get my skill worked in for that day and just played pickup. I don't know. I'd almost feel, yeah, like I maybe cheated today, you know?
Yep.
And so there was definitely, I would say I was definitely more I leaned more toward making sure I got the individual stuff in. And then would, especially as I got older and got to college, you know, that was something that I would kind of carry on of making sure that, you know, then I implemented weights in college. I had weights in high school. We weren't really lifting much on college. I implemented a weight piece then with my skill work. And then, you know, would try to get a pickup in following that.
The first training camp, Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine, will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
Were you putting together your workouts? Were you consulting with your dad? Who, just again, obviously today, kid wants to put together a workout. You just go on, you search, you find some drills, or you can go work with a trainer. But back in the era when you're playing, you're kind of on your own. So how'd you put together or figure out what you want to work on during those individual workouts that you do?
Some were initially my dad would have some ideas for me that I follow. I had an older cousin who coached and played at an NAIA McMurray University. Now it's at Division III in Abilene. And he kind of took me under his wing, and he put me through some stuff, some college level stuff. And then as I was getting recruited, I was lucky. I still remember at University of Tennessee was kind of recruiting me. They sent me letters and there's a difference between letters and phone calls. I don't know if they were sort of recruiting me, but they did send me. It was Kevin O'Neill, I think, was the coach at the time. And he had a workout plan that he sent out and just a sample of what they would do. And it was a Tennessee workout. And I mean, to this day, I can probably recall what a majority of that was. And I started doing that my junior summer, I think, is when I got that. Yeah. And it was about an hour long workout that consisted of, you know, layups, mid-range jumpers, threes, stuff off the bounce, stuff off the catch. And it was good. And it was one that I just always felt exhausted after doing. And so, I would, you know, I think now it's, you know, you're right. Like it's so nice now that guys can have so many resources to go and find this stuff. And, you know, if you're in the gym a lot, you also, it's like anything, you kind of start creating your own.
For sure.
You know, you kind of start coming up with your own ideas and your own things you felt like you needed to improve on. And you would, you know, I was really big. I used to line up in my driveway. I would line these, like I'd get four trash cans and a cone in the middle. And I would, like in a diamond shape with those trash cans, and that cone would be in the middle. And I would attack that cone like it was a defender, then make a quick move to that next trash can and turn right back around and attack the cone and do that for like 25, 30 seconds. Just to work on trying to gain my first step. And something I do with our guys now, and I do it, it's interesting. Some of that stuff that I kind of created as a player, I use now because I felt like it was pretty beneficial.
Yeah, absolutely. When does coaching get on your radar? At what point do you start thinking about being a coach? Was that something that was always in the back of your mind because of the influence of your dad? Or was it more like, hey, I'm a player and I'm not really seeing the coaching piece of it? Did it come to you gradually? Just how would you describe your arrival on the fact that, hey, I want to get into coaching?
I think it started kind of popping in my brain my junior, senior year of college. You know, I wanted to play as long as I could. And when I got finished at Tech, I had a chance to go with the Rockets and play in the Rocky Mountain Review out in Utah. I saw there that jump to that next level was going to be obviously really difficult. And I kind of was at a crossroad of, hey, do I go play? At the time, there was no G League. There was no developmental league and that stuff. And I don't know if I could have played in it, but that wasn't an option. So it's like, okay, do I go play over in Australia or go somewhere? And I just, that didn't sound as tempting to me at the time as, you know, maybe it should have just because of the life experience you get out of doing that. But I just, at that point, I started thinking, yeah, you know, I know I got to stay in the game. I just don't know how. So I spent a couple of years finishing up school in Lubbock and Tech. And during that time, had a chance to, you know, be kind of away from the game a little bit and realize how much I miss being a part of it. And so it just kind of drew me back into it. And you know, I ran some camps during that time. And it's interesting. During that time, I got to really, really study. My dad always had the Pete Newell videos. And I got to really, really study that stuff and got on the phone with him a couple of times and his son and was really studying footwork and all that. And so I was getting my fix of of that, and then had a chance to do radio when Bob Knight got hired at Texas Tech, and getting the chance to be at his practices a couple of days a week was really kind of excited me. And it was just something different and something new. And it was really, from a basketball perspective, it was just a great experience, you know? And so seeing that kind of got me excited and kind of got me where I was kind of revved back up and ready. You know, I think part of it too, when I got done playing, I had put so much of my life into it. I think I was a little bit tired, honestly. Like, that's the only probably negative of not taking, like, I miss, you know, I always tell people, man, being really successful, I think it can be really lonely, because you don't take vacations. You don't go on trips. Like in college, I never made it to a spring break. I never made it to a family coach trip or any of that stuff, you know, because I didn't want to miss those days. So yep. I think it's great, but also I think at some point when you're done, you feel like you've run a marathon and you need to take a little time to get your body back. And I think that kind of was where I was when all that wrapped up for me. It was like, man, that was a whirlwind. That was all in. I was 100% committed and probably need to refuel up my drive for that. And so that's a couple of years, I think, helped me do that and helped me get excited to start the next journey.
What about coaching did you love right from the very beginning?
The competition. I think, you know, that's what I realized I missed. Even doing, you know, I did radio that year with Texas Tech. It was fun. And I got to work with an all-time legend, a guy named Jack Dale, who had done it for 49 years, and got to travel and be around the team and learn from Coach Knight in practice. But it's different when you have zero impact or influence on the game. And I was so used to having an impact on it. So the competition was initially what was great about it. And as I've gotten older, I think it's, you know, it's all the other pieces of it, you know, the relationships you build in the profession with other coaches is terrific. It's one of the things that kind of keeps you going. And then obviously the relationship with the players, and as you get older, you think you learn to appreciate that more, and you learn to enjoy those moments more with the team, and not be, you can kind of separate yourself a little more and not put so much of yourself into it. I think you learn that, but yeah, no, I think just being back into building something was something I'd miss, even though I didn't really know what I was building. It was just fun to be going through the process of acting like you're trying to build something.
What influences from your dad do you still feel like are a part of your coaching today? What have you taken from him and all the time that you spent with him and watching him and playing for him, talking with him, that has become an integral part of who you are as a coach?
Oh, I think style of play. You know, we press and we try to play fast and try to play with tempo and that. So I think that was part of it. And the flexibility of, you know, within the coaching construct or whatever, to think outside the box and to try to see players. I think I got this from him, but the ability, and I've recognized it again when I went back and watched his team play, when teams play once I was done playing, the ability to see what players could do beyond what maybe they're seeing themselves be able to do. And I know a lot of coaches probably do that, but I think the system he created allowed players with certain skill sets to maybe flourish more than they did or would have in other systems. And so seeing that, and now trying to recruit to that and watching guys play and seeing some things that you think you can maybe work with and allow some guys to maybe have success doing some things they didn't realize they could do based on a vision that you have for them, knowing how they fit in the system you're trying to play.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think when you talk about the influence that somebody that you spent as much time with as you spent with your dad. I mean, you can't help but think that there's probably a million things that rubbed off on you that you just absorbed through osmosis of just being around him for such a long period of time. When you think about your stints as an assistant at the college level, what are one or two things that you picked up during your time as an assistant that when you got the job at Concordia that you feel have made you a better head coach because of what you learned as an assistant?
I think obviously the value of recruiting and, you know, how important that can be, seeing, you know, programs that, that had good players and what that has, what that meant and what that was, what difference that made. I think also just learning how involved you have to be with players' day-to-day activities in order to keep things moving. I think that's one of the things I struggled with probably early on as an assistant was I just didn't understand, you know, that these guys are different than I was. And so in some ways good too, because it's not like I was always the most focused academic student and you know, I had my priorities in mind because I didn't. But you think all guys will have that they just maybe don't understand or don't know how to have. And so being involved with, you know, getting helping with you know, get making sure assignments are getting turned in, just, you know, the academic side of things and realizing and also just realizing how to organize a practice and run a practice and how to create expectations for the style and the way you want to play and how you conduct yourself daily in a practice influences that. And so I think being around that and being able to observe that for a couple of years helped me at least have a head start on, okay, like how involved I got, you got to be in again, a lot of the administrative process, whether it's the recruiting side of things, whether it's the eligibility side, whatever it may be, like you have to just, you got to make sure that if you need something done, it gets done. And not assuming that because a player says something is good, it's good. You know, and I think all that was kind of eye-opening to me when I first started as an assistant. And again, I think I'd be a lot better now, honestly, as an assistant, because I understand so much more of all of those pieces that come together to form that pie that a head coach is trying to put together. And just how important it is to help, you know, take some of those off the plate of the head coach.
There's no doubt that being able to understand the needs of your head coach, I think, is probably one of the best qualities of an assistant. Whenever I talk to somebody who is an assistant, has been an assistant, and is working their way up the coaching ladder, I think that's one of the things that they consistently say is, look, I try to add the most value that I possibly can by trying to anticipate the need. Yeah. What my head coach is. And I think if you can learn that as an assistant, that helps you then when you become a head coach, because conversely, now you kind of know what you're looking for in a good assistant and how they can help you and make your program better. How does the opportunity at Concordia get on your radar? What does that process look like?
You know, I'd played at Concordia as a high school game. We played Temple High School, met halfway in between the two spots in Temple. It's a town right outside of Waco. At the time, they were number one or two in the state. It was my junior year, and we were number maybe six or seven. Well, we met at Concordia and actually played them, and we beat them on a last-second shot. It was a crazy game and a great win. But so I knew of the school, and I knew, you know, my cousin played at McMurray, which was the Division III, and he coached at McMurray and had a ton of success there as an assistant. And I knew players that had played at Concordia, and so when the job popped open during my second year as an assistant, when I was at South Plains, you know, the opportunity was there, and I knew that it was a job, or I felt like it was a job that was potentially gettable. It was closer to San Antonio, which is where I was from, and it was in a great city. And so I was in town, and I just happened to I had put together my stuff and walked in to the gym, and the AD happened to be there that day, and I just gave her my info and introduced myself, and we talked for a minute or two, and said they'd be going through the process of getting candidates in line. And then it was just, you know, through the interviewing process, I worked really hard at trying to create a book to give them with all my philosophies. And who knows what those philosophies were worth. You know, you think you're right. It's not like, I guarantee everyone back looks at it. I'm probably not following any of those philosophies at this point in my life, but this, all that stuff out and had some good references and was able to, I'll give Linda Lowry's lady who hired me, and I can't thank her enough, because I was probably 26 at the time, but I was really young. And, I was in my head, I was qualified, but I don't really know if I was qualified for the job. I probably wasn't. And, it was a job that paid very, very low. And it was, it didn't have it had tradition, but it had, it didn't have a ton of recent success, I guess. And so they took a chance. And my first couple of years, we really struggled. But I felt like we were, on a good path, and slowly but surely over time kind of built it up. But, it was a definite break that I got. And I know that having been a successful player in the state, man, and having some of the history really helped me, because I'm sure there was, from a coaching standpoint, more qualified candidates. But I think the thing that I did have going for me is I felt like I was very, very low maintenance, and I wasn't concerned about salary. I didn't have, I was 26. I didn't have, family or anything. So I was able to I think come with very little strings. And again, I was, the other thing too, when you take a job like that, I was the basketball coach, but I was a game day administrator. So I was working soccer games and working baseball and volleyball and teaching a freshman life and leadership class and doing multiple things that I think, honestly, there may have been more qualified coaches who just didn't want to mess with some of that stuff. They didn't want to spend their Saturday afternoons out at a soccer field from, noon to seven while being in the process of trying to do all that stuff. So I learned to love it, though. Honestly, I learned to love being a part of all those different events, because it's a chance to learn and a chance to get connected and really open my eyes to a different level and to a different idea of what a university could be. And it's been great since I've been here.
What's something that over the course of your career you feel like you weren't very good at when you first started as a head coach that now you feel like you've gotten a handle on and you've really improved upon?
I really hope it's like me and Coach Cook talk about, we talk about, take your job serious, but not yourself. And I think that's something I hope I've gotten better at is understanding that this is really important, but to me, that it's not as important to everybody else as what you think it is. And I think I've gotten better at using that perspective to help me remove myself from outcomes. Like, I don't know. I feel like I don't really care about my record. I mean, I do, but I don't. I think I've done this for a long enough period of time to where I know that does not define the job you're doing as a coach. That, it's so much is about, are you improving? Are you, are the guys getting better? Are they figuring it out? Are we learning from previous experience? And are we not focusing on winning? It's like trying to make a shot, man. You can't focus on trying to make a shot, because if you're trying to make it, you're aiming, you're never going to make. You got to just get, you know, you got to follow the steps and put the work in. And then if it's open, shoot and hope it goes in. And I think it's the same thing with coaching. I think you follow the steps, you work, you do your prep, you don't cheat the system, you don't cheat what you're doing. And then you hope when the ball's tipped, you know, you're going to adjust and you're going to coach, but you also, you know, hope you can make more shots than the opponent or keep them from scoring more. And it's not a reflection. I think so much becomes the idea of, like, you as a coach get so frustrated with what's going on because there can be an insecurity about the performance being a reflection directly on you. And I think when that happens is when you can start losing the team, because it makes you act out of character. So I think I've kind of adopted the idea. I want to coach teams, guys who I want to lose with, as weird as that may sound, like, because when you, I mean, it's easy to be around people when you win, right? Like everybody's had for the most part. It's just when you lose, who are the people you want to surround yourself with? And so trying to recruit to that and still recruit talent, but recruit talented guys who are with things, I think that helps you stay in the process when you're all on the same page about that. And so I think we've gotten better about that. I still get upset when we get beat, and I'm still, you know, have a hard time with it, but I've been able to, I guess, recover from it better than I could 10 or 12 years ago. 10 or 12 years ago, I'd want to just go lay in the fetal position and turn the lights off and be in a dark place. And now it's like, you know, like, hey, you know, like we did what we could do. We got to get these guys better. And at the end of the day, like this, again, this, it's not, it doesn't make the other coach that you're playing a better coach than you. And sometimes they are, but it's just, it's also like there's some factors that are out of your control. I think just removing the ego from it and helping and having your guys do it. I think if you do that, your team can do that. And they can really not be dictated. You're going to celebrate the wins. But like last year, we went through a skid where we lost 9 straight. But it was great because we learned and we valued, started valuing moving our feet. We started valuing, you know, guarding the ball, blocking it. Little things that we were 8-4 to start the season last year. And everybody was talking about how good we were. But we weren't, like, and I knew we weren't. We weren't doing things I knew we would. And we lost 9 games, and 3 or 4 of them were literally one possession games or free throw, like literally free throw line to win games, to seal games, missing free throws. They come down his shot. And like we were prepared, ultimately, you know, can't make the free throw for the guys. And we stayed the course to where we got in the net. We got in our conference tournament and we played the number 1 seed, Mary Harden Baylor, who's really good. And right now I think they're ranked number 2 in the country preseason. But, you know, we played those guys and we're tied with 2 minutes ago and in the conference tournament, miss a blockout and we lose the game by 5. But I mean, we got better. And I saw that, and I didn't let the fact that we were losing these games steer us off course from what I knew we were doing, you know? And so I think just being able to keep yourself locked in on the day-to-day steps of it is something that I do better now, and not more so than whenever I first started this thing. Because when I first started, it was, if you don't win, you're not good.
Right.
And I think I've matured. And because I think when you think that way, it also impacts how you recruit, you know, because then you're going to recruit whatever you know, hey, I'm going to just go get the best guy.
Right.
I don't care what may come with it, what you may have to deal with. I don't care what principles I'm going against. Hey, if this guy can help me win, I got to win, because I got to be able to tell people when I go out to eat or when I'm walking on campus, my record was this and this, because I don't want to have to explain why it wasn't. So you want to just cover that, but you're not able. That's only temporary, I think. And so I think I've become a little more in touch with that, which has made coaching the last several years. Honestly, it hasn't been the most successful from a win-loss standpoint, but it's been it's been fun. I mean, each year I thought by the end of the season, we're playing our best basketball. I feel like we are, we peaked at the right times, and I don't know if we will this year, but I feel like we have. And I feel like the relationships we have with our guys have been probably better than ever based on staying true to who we're trying to be.
And that's the process, right? I mean, that's the thing where you start looking at it and saying, we're going about it. We're doing it the right way. We're doing it the right way from the moment we start recruiting a kid. We're bringing in good people that we think are going to be a good fit in our program. And obviously you want them to be talented, and they're going to be talented players. And but ultimately that character piece of who you want to be around day in and day out, that's a huge part of it. And then you start going to, look, we're going to prepare our team, and we're going to do the things that we need to do in practice to put ourselves in the best position to win. And sometimes you're going to win games and sometimes you're not. And look, I get it from talking to you and from talking to any coach that everybody loves to win games, and everybody's out here. And ultimately at some point you get judged to some degree on your one loss record, but there's really more to it. And I think the more you as a coach can focus in on that process piece of it of, hey, we're doing things the right way. We're doing things the right way in terms of the kids we're bringing into the program, in terms of the positions that we're putting them in out on the floor, in terms of helping them to not just become better basketball players, but also become great students and better people. And all those things, I think, all add up to, it sounds like from what you're saying, that I get the sense that there's a level of satisfaction that you have at this point in your career that you might not have ever been able to get to when you were younger.
No, 100%. I think again, so much of what, I was so concerned or so consumed with winning because of what I thought it meant to, what I thought it meant for me, for my reputation, for how others viewed me as a coach. And I really don't care at this point, honestly. I don't mind telling people, how we did. And I mean, it's never a fun conversation, but like at the end of the day, it's like, and this is what it is. And people who know, and the people who don't, it doesn't matter. And so I just think removing that from your self as a coach, and again, still being competitive, you still want to win, and you're not, you're never just gonna roll off. You still put all the time and you work harder in some ways, but it makes it strictly about the process of improvement for your guys. And I know everybody says process has become kind of a niche thing to say, but I was audio booking. This was like 4 or 5 years ago, a book by Ryan Holiday that said Ego is the Enemy. And it was just what the name of it is. And
love that
it just
book.
It just kind of shaped my thinking and kind of allowed me to realize, all this concern, all this pressure, that's just my ego that's getting in the way of all this. And I got to remove that. And I got to not care. I got to truly do this for the right reason and live with the results. It doesn't make it always easier, but again, I just think it helps with perspective and helps you be able to navigate the profession a little bit easier.
When do you think that as a head coach, you got to that realization that we've been talking about and sort of were able to pin down what your philosophy, for lack of a better way of saying it, both in terms of the kind of culture you wanted to build and in terms of what you wanted to do out on the floor, X's and O's wise? I know there's going to be adjustments and things that you do differently year to year, depending on your personnel, but how long did it take you into your stint before you felt like, hey, I've got an identity. Inside, I know who I am. I know what kind of coach I am, and I know what kind of product that I want to put out on the floor, what kind of coach I want to be for the kids that are part of my program. How long did that take?
I think the idea of like stylistically how we wanted to play in that, I knew right away. I knew kind of what we wanted to do. I knew the type of game I wanted to play, I knew the style I wanted to play. But as far as becoming like comfortable with approach and how I was going to, you know, coach the guys and again, perspective and all that stuff. I think that's honestly been the last 4 or 5 years that I've been able to really kind of take on that mantra of, again, I want to recruit the best players we can, but we also want to recruit guys who, when we're coming back on that bus and we got an 8-hour trip and we lost that game, like, who do I want to be on that bus with? And who do I want to be at that, you know, that restaurant with when we're eating after a tough loss? And who do I want to, you know, all like, who do you want to be around? And I think that has taken me a while to grasp. And I think that's only been the last couple of years probably that I've really become more and more comfortable with that idea of I'm willing to sacrifice some of this from a guy to get some of this, you know, like, and even if that means, you know, we may have, because I also know ultimately if you're not in alignment, you're not going to win.
Right.
You know, if you don't have guys who you really feel that way about, you're not going to win. It's going to bite you at some point. At some point, that disconnect between your philosophy as a coach and the players not matching can cover for a little while, but at the wrong time in the wrong moment, that disconnect is going to rear its head and it's going to hurt, because it's going to come at a time whenever you need it the most. And I'd rather at the time I need it the most, know what I got, you know, and know what I'm in that moment with and be comfortable with that and have confidence that in that moment, I got the right guys with me to get through this moment together, as opposed to just, you know, masking it and kind of just coexist. I don't want to coexist with players. You know what I mean? Like, I want to build with them, and I want to grow with them, and I don't think you can do that in any relationship if you can't be your authentic self, you know. And so I'd rather be my authentic self and have players for their own, because I think that creates an environment of you know, non-fraudulence, of trust, of realness. That is what is how you go win tough games on the road. You don't win tough games with, you know, an idea of what a team is or a culture is. No, it's got to be real, and you got to have real conversations. You got to be able to have, you know, real talks, and you can only do that with people who, you know, who you believe in and who you have good relationships with.
Looking to grow your coaching? United Basketball Plus has over 3,000 plays and 45 deep dive courses with some of the best minds in the game, including Tyler Costin, Paul Kelleher, Tobin Anderson, Dave Love, and more. You can also view their United Basketball clinics and receive 50% off in-person clinics. United Basketball Plus has partnered with Jordan and Joe's Decision for their skill development curriculum. United Basketball Plus is a one-stop shop to help you grow as a coach, leader, and culture builder. Follow the link in the show notes and use the code CLINIC to receive an annual membership for just $50.
What does that look like on the recruiting trail when you're going out and you're trying to evaluate what players you want to bring into your program? Are there intangible things that you're looking for from the player? Are there questions that you're asking of them, their family, their high school coach or AAU coach? Just what's your process like when you're recruiting a player to figure out whether or not they're going to be a good fit for your culture?
You know, I think part of it, you know, it starts with the evaluation of watching them play. Clearly the talent piece, but also like just how are they carrying themselves throughout a game? And it's, you know, how are they responding after success, after failure? How are they responding to coaching? And then when you're having conversations with them, you know, what is, are they, do they have some, I really like it when a player has some hubris, has some humility, some self-awareness. I think that's like when you can tell a player is self-aware through conversations and when they're able to communicate about the success or failures they've had in a way that is real. I think that's really, really important. And I think we, you know, through conversations with the coaches, we're just, there's there's little cues that we pick up on, you know, as far as how a player acts when they get on campus, how they, you know, communicate with you, with parents, with, and when we're at lunch, you know, are you able to talk to them? Are you able to have a conversation with them? Are you able to get below the surface level of just the answer that are, but the answers they think they're supposed to give? And can we create that connection there where there can be some real talk and some joke and some seriousness, but something that kind of creates an avenue that she's like, okay, I can see myself spending time around this guy. They're not just checking off boxes whenever we are talking, they're not just getting through it, but there's some actual genuineness with it. I wouldn't say we have specific questions or we have anything specific that we put them through, as much as we're watching for the traits we know we value. And it's good when, you know, I've had great assistants, but the guy I have now, I think, is terrific. And he is, you know, he's all about the same stuff. And so when he's out watching, when he tells me, hey, the coach, this guy, you know, make it, he wouldn't be, you know, he's super talented, but man, we, you know, I've tried to call him. I was supposed to talk to him at 11 o'clock and I called, he didn't answer. And then this and this, it's like, you know, we start marking guys off.
Right.
We just know, okay, yeah, he's not meeting this in this box, or, you know, it's just certain things that you kind of pick up on that it helps when you're, again, it really, really helps, obviously, the sit and big news, but when your staff is in alignment, it makes things much easier to get through.
Watching a kid in AAU versus watching them play with their high school team, are there different things that you're looking for depending on the environment? Do you prefer one environment over the other when it comes to evaluation? How do you approach that piece of it?
You know, I think with the AAU piece, I like watching that because a lot of times, depending on who it is and where it is, the level of competition, you know, when you see him, you're going to probably see, you know, a pretty high level that they're going to be, or a good level they're going to be going against. So high school, it can be hit or miss. The high school I really like, though, because being in Texas my whole life, I got a pretty good idea of, you know, how high school programs were run. And so being able to see players play in certain systems under certain coaches and know how they respond to those coaches is really, really good. And it's really a positive for me. And it's something that we lean on a lot, is knowing whether it's in Houston, Dallas, wherever, knowing the program they're coming from, the coach you're playing for, and being able to have a conversation with that coach, knowing kind of what their expectation is really helpful. It's really, really something that has been good for us for all this time.
Once you get a kid on campus, one of the challenges that we talk to Division III coaches here on the pod, clearly the rules and how much you guys can have contact with your players when you're not in season can be challenging to build those relationships where you don't have as much unfettered access as they do at the Division I level, which I guess I would kind of argue almost is too much. But thinking about from the Division III level, just what do you do? What are some things, some ways that you try to go about building relationships with your guys?
Well, and for us recently, me and my assistant got our strength and conditioning certification. And so we're able to work. We have to work with the entire athletic department, but we're able to work with our guys with strength and conditioning in the fall, which helps because that allows us to initially build relationships and start when they first get to campus, communicating with them and talking to them and that. So that helps. You know, we have, you know, mandatory study halls the guys come to where he gives a chance to at least see him two or three times a week. And then we'll do individual meetings at the beginning of the year just to kind of meet with guys and talk to them about kind of their transition and kind of how that's going as they're here. And really, you know, we even in the summer, you know, we'll have a lot of summer camps and we'll hire some of our, you know, players and deposit recruits to come and work that. And just trying to get them on campus and just be around them as much as we can before October 15th, just so we're not strangers to them. I think doing all that together has helped. you know, it's really, because before we were certified, we really, we'd have the study halls and we would have a, maybe a community service activity we would do, but we weren't able to be with them in any kind of environment that we're going to be with them in once we actually start practice. And so that's helped being able to, you can see in that second week of school, we're up in the weight room, whatever, you know.
Yeah. And that's one thing, right, for your returning players where, you know, you've already got a built-in relationship with them, but I would think with freshmen, with incoming guys, and here you have such limited contact with them, that's got to be a challenge. I'm sure that by the time you get to October 15th with those guys, you know, before you were able to get in with the strength and conditioning piece of it, that, man, you're like ready to go with those freshmen who you brought in, and you want to start getting to know them and build that relationship, and just to not be able to have as much time with them as you like. I'm guessing that was pretty tough.
Yes. No, 100%. Like you, again, you recruit them and you tell them how much you want them here, and you almost see them more when you recruit them than when you get on campus, you know?
Yeah, right.
And so they get there and it's like, wait a second, coach, I thought we were going to be in the gym. I thought we were going to be doing this and this. Like, well, we got a couple months and then we'll see. So yes, it definitely, just having that allows, even though it is different once you get on the court, it's nice just to see them for 45 minutes, you know, 5 days a week out, you know, in a, somewhat of a sports arena, you know? And so that was, you know, part of it was, hey, we need to do, get the certification so that we can, you know, get stronger and in shape to this when we start season, but also just so we can be around them. And you can, you know, start, I mean, it's all volunteer stuff, but you can see when those guys show up then, like who is, you know, some of those characteristics start showing pretty early.
Absolutely.
What you're going to get from them. So it also helps from a team dynamic and team shaping mindset of being able to start to kind of piece that together.
What's your philosophy as far as practice design and trying to make sure that you're creating the most competitive, intense practices that you can? What is your, what's your routine look like when you're putting together a practice plan? You can either take it for preseason, kind of before you start playing games, or if you want to take it into the season where you're preparing for a particular opponent. What's just, how do you go about sitting down and putting together a practice plan? When do you do it? How do you do it? What, what's the process?
Man, we, you know, me and my assistant, well, it can be a tedious one, obviously. It's one of my least enjoyable parts of the day, because I know it's never going to be a simple process. But yeah, me and my assistant will sit down and kind of have a list of things we know we want to accomplish and get through, you know, before, you know, certain days, certain times. And we'll, you know, we'll sit down and you know, kind of want to mix in. You know, I've always been, in the past, I was a part whole part guy. And this is the first year we're doing kind of whole part whole. And so, you know, we've done more of that this year of trying to show the big picture to guys. And then, you know, from there, break it down into drills. And so, you know, I think it's just, we try to teach it, you know, maybe rep it and then scrimmage it, and really try to put point systems on as much as we can. But also we've started implementing certain non-negotiables we want in whatever we're doing, whether it's, you know, our practice used to be a breakdown of about 75-80% defense, 20% offense. And now I think it's probably more 50-50, kind of what we're doing. But, you know, we've gotten to the point now where so much of what we value, we'll just get towels out. And if guys, you know, aren't doing it, then they know they got towel slides, whatever that may be. So, you know, whether it's getting, you know, right now, our big thing is blow-bys if we're not guarding the ball, or if we miss a block out, or if we don't move on ball flight. Like, there's two or three things that, as we're seeing, and if it doesn't happen, instead of yelling and getting mad and getting frustrated, we just tell them, go get a towel and go push it. And so, you know, we try to early on, we want to instill for us with pressing, a big part of our early practices is mindset. So we'll sacrifice maybe a little bit technical to make sure we're really, really emphasizing mindset and toughness and competition and you know, really, really trying to instill how we want to play, how we want to get after people, how we want to guard, the effort, the speed. Big thing with us is urgency. So whatever we're doing, we want to be urgent, whether we're going through a, you know, some skill work, whether we're going through defensive work or whatever it may be. It's we're trying to move fast, move quick, and not waste much time. And so I think if you came, you would see a practice of urgency. I think you'd understand kind of the mindset of what we're trying to do and how we're trying to play.
How do you recognize those things that you're looking for in practice? Do you go in with an emphasis on, okay, hey, we're struggling with box outs? So do you put a focus like that on practice in a particular day where, hey, yeah, we're looking for this thing? And then when you do notice those things, because we all know what you can praise is going to get repeated. And so as you're going through, how do you make sure that the players know what's important to you on a given day? I mean, obviously over the course of playing for you, they can start to understand what are the things that are most important to you. But day to day, how do you make sure that the things that you want to emphasize are the things that the players are feeling?
I think for us this year, what we've started doing is, you know, I spent a lot of time over the summer clipping and putting together off synergy, some things that we value on both sides of the ball. And so we've started kind of bringing guys in and having a film, 15 minutes film session with them over whatever it may be, whether it's, you know, our 2-2-1 press and in first level conversion, and understanding that first level conversion is really, really important in trying to be a good pressure defensive team. And so we'll show them 5 minutes of clips of first level conversion. And then they know throughout that practice as we're working, you know, in our press defense that this is what we're going to design drills. We're going to design games that are going to compete and value guys who are getting to that conversion quickly. And there's going to be winners and losers in that competition. And then we're going to take it from there to more of a 4-on-4, 5-on-5, where again, all those times when we're doing that, there's a high emphasis on it. And if you're not doing it again, there's usually a towel involved with it. And if you are doing it, then it's going to use your reward at some type of point. It's going to give you a chance to win whatever it is. So again, it may be that next day, it may be, hey, we're going to really emphasize our offensive spacing and movement plan and making sure whenever we have advantages, we're doing this and this. We're going to show you some video on it, and then we're going to expect you to do it. And same type of thing, we're going to set up competitive drills for you to do it where you're being rewarded for it and you're playing for it. And then we're going to do it in a 5-on-5 scrimmage. So we've really tried to find those things daily that we feel like are really, really important points of emphasis that maybe we've struggled at either last year or we're sitting in practice, and then we'll try to film it, show it, go out there, emphasize it, and then put some type of value system toward it once we start scrimmaging.
When you're watching film, and obviously you as a coach, you're putting a lot more time on the film and looking through whether it's opponents or looking at your own stuff. But when you're sharing with players, how do you balance out how much you show them of, hey, here's what we're doing really well and those positive clips versus showing them, hey, here's where we fell short of what the expectation is? How do you balance those when you're sharing film with players?
I think it kind of depends on time of the season. I think early on, it's probably trying to maybe be a little more balanced with it because you're trying to encourage success and show them what success looks like. I think as the season goes on, I fall in more of a pattern of where we aren't doing it, because I feel like at that point we should understand it. And if we're not, we need to show them where it's not happening, and then try to fix it.
What do you think when you look over the totality of your time at Concordia? What do you think has been the one or two things that you can point to that you're most proud of, that you think have had the most impact on your success as a program and as a head coach?
I think I think the couple of things. I think one is the satisfaction the guys feel when they're finished with the level of work that we put in, and the idea of not being cheated from what they signed up for. So I think most guys leave the program feeling pretty satisfied that they got their minds worked, that there was time put in by them, by coaches, and their opportunity to succeed was done at a was done with a pretty, you know, high level of intention. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing is just the alumni, the relationship base that we've been able to form with players over the years, and the way that has kind of grown, and you see it now generationally passed down, and you see guys from different eras, you know, coming together and connected and all having that same bond over having gone through some of the same stuff they've gone through during their time. So I think those areas of knowing that, you know, the guys have had a good experience, if you feel like, and they've been able to share that with people and they are able to come back and share it with guys who have done before them.
What's the best part of being a Division III head coach? What do you love about the Division III level?
Oh, I love the fact that it's the collegiate level. You know, you can recruit to it. And you're able to recruit guys who have, you know, it feels like able to keep pretty good perspective on things. You know, it's stayed, you know, I feel like it has stayed for the most part pretty true to what the game is supposed to be, you know. And so I also love the fact that, like, you see a lot of guys who just have so much more grit than I had when I was in school. You know, they're seeing guys that are, you just appreciate guys that are working jobs and, you know, taking classes and coming to practice and just, man, some of these guys were really tough. The stuff they do to play, people have no idea. Like, it's really hard. It's really hard, man. These guys are paying rent every month at their apartments that are off campus, and they're leaving practice on the 31st of October in the spring. They got to get home and make sure the rent check in. And, you know, they're doing that while maybe some guys are working in the on-campus dining hall and some guys are working off campus. And it's impressive, man. And all the time they're taking 15 hours. And it's like, man, I was not near the student athlete. Didn't have near the toughness, man. These guys, it's impressive. It really, I always tell them, they may have it harder now than guys are at higher levels, but, man, they're going to have it much easier when they're done because they're prepared. They're having to already balance so much in their life that majority of college athletes don't have to balance. So I've really, again, as I've gotten older, I think I've really grown to respect that and just admire the fact that guys are able to do that. It's really, really an impressive thing.
Yeah, that's unique to the Division III level. I think when you start talking about just how different it is, and I mentioned it, you know, a second ago, and I know you know better than anybody, just the way that Division I is set up now and the amount of access that the coaching staffs have to players today and the workouts in the summertime and all this, and it just sort of becomes, again, that's your full-time job. And at the Division III level, you can actually have a player who can – have a job and just be involved in other things on campus. And there's certainly the opportunity to have a more well-rounded, I think, college experience than you can have maybe at some of the higher levels, which again is something that not everybody thinks about when they're trying to make a decision about where they're going to go to school. We're coming up, Stan, here close to an hour and a half. I want to wrap up by asking you one final two-part question. First part is, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what's the biggest challenge that you see in front of you? And then the second part is, when you think about what you get to do every day, what brings you the most joy about being the head coach at Concordia? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
Biggest challenge would be just, you know, I think, like always, continuing to just have that sustained level of energy and enthusiasm that every day as you go to work and as you get it, and with your team, the challenge of having those guys, having your team continue to have that that level of energy and excitement on a daily basis is tough. For 6 months to strap up, you know, to do it every day is challenging. But I think that's why it's important for me personally. I try to stay in shape and try to keep my body right and all that stuff, because I think that definitely contributes to that. And I think also just keeping the guys, you know, moving forward and trying to continue to live with that process mindset and continuing to try to get the guys to be 100% committed to that. I think biggest joy is just, you know, my job just doesn't feel like a job. It's hard at times, you know, and it is stressful and all that, but I mean, I'm going to spend majority of my day tomorrow thinking about basketball, watching basketball and being in the gym, practicing basketball. So it's pretty cool that's what I've been able to do, you know, for going on 17, 18, and however many years now, you know, just, and being able to just, I think as I get older, appreciate the relationships with our players more. I really do feel like as the years have gone on, I've been able to appreciate those more and more than I did probably when I was younger. So just continuing to form those and develop those is something I'm looking forward to continuing to do this year.
Yeah, that's good stuff. I think those relationships, there's nothing better than 5, 10, 15 years after a kid leaves you, that you're getting those calls and you're still in contact with them and you still have those relationships. That's, you love winning games, but ultimately that impact and those relationships, that's really what it's all about. And it's been fun. That's what this podcast has kind of become, is just, again, getting an opportunity to know coaches and people from all over the country and all different facets of the game, and being able to have conversations just made it so much fun. Before we wrap up, go ahead.
No, I'm saying absolutely, yeah.
So before we get out, I want to give you a chance to share how people can reach out to you, whether you want to share social media, email, website, whatever you feel comfortable with, and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, myself, anybody has questions, it's 512-796-9278. Email is my first name, stan.bonowitz@concordia.edu. And you can follow me on @StanBonowitz on Twitter. But yeah, if anybody ever has questions or anything, man, please feel free. I'm always, you know, reaching out and trying to learn from other people. So if I can ever be of any assistance, be more than happy to. And I appreciate you having me on and taking time to ask these questions and get to know more about me as a person and coach and professional is really, you know, thoughtful of you. And I, you know, I appreciate you thinking enough of me or this opportunity to have me on for this period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. We cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule. I'm glad that Andre Cook connected us, and really thankful that there are coaches like you that are out there that are willing to share their story and willing to share the game and jump on here with us and have a conversation. So again, thank you for your time tonight, and to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.